come live into the studio. We are also going out to you via KBOO.FM. And in that manner to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fogring. This is the 49 years ago, last Tuesday, Martin Luther King was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. And that's what we're going to talk about today. I have a book. It's called The Plot to Kill King by William Pepper. Pepper was an attorney and a peace activist and a colleague of Dr. King. And this is actually the third book he's written on the assassination. First book was called Orders to Kill. Then came An Act of State. And now The Plot to Kill King. The main difference is that they're about the same topic, but this most recent book is greatly enlarged. It's a pretty thick book, but a little over half the book is appendices, court documents, cross-examinations, witness depositions, all kinds of evidence. So that is the book. It's published by, see if I can find the publisher here, Skyhorse Publishing. Apparently I got the last copy from Powell's, but I'm sure you can go to your favorite bookstore and you can order a copy yourself. It is really worth reading. It's an eye-opening book. So let's set the scene. In April of 1968, Martin Luther King was in Memphis to support the garbage workers' strike. And he was staying at the Lorraine Motel on Mulberry Street. Now, when he first arrived there, he had a sort of a secluded room, but then it was changed to a room on the second floor overlooking the parking area and Mulberry Street itself. And this change of rooms is arranged. You can read the book and find out by who. It's a very interesting sidelight to the story. So anyway, King is at the Lorraine Motel on Mulberry Street. Also in the neighborhood, in the room next to him, was a group called the Invaders. They were kind of a militant group who were acting kind of as Dr. King's bodyguards. And about 20 minutes before the assassination, they were asked to leave their room, supposedly because the bill hadn't been paid for that night. But this is almost 6 o'clock at night when this order came. Kind of strange. Well, they did leave. Also in the neighborhood, there were some army photographers, and they were on the roof of a fire station across the street from the motel. Further away, on the roof of the Illinois Central Railroad building, which kind of overlooked everything, was a sniper team from Special Forces Alpha 184. Okay, so Dr. King is staying at the Lorraine Motel. Across the street, across Mulberry Street, is an 8-foot retaining wall, and then a yard, an empty yard full of brush and little trees, and the backs of some buildings on the next street over, which was South Main Street. So, shortly after 6 in the evening, a shot was fired from across the street that hit King and eventually killed him. Witnesses had seen smoke and people coming out of the bushes. When a driver named Solomon Jones, who was King's chauffeur, saw a man come out of those bushes at the back of those buildings, jump down the wall and disappear. A cab driver named Buddy Butler saw a man jump from the wall and get into a police car. The very next day, Buddy Butler was killed. He was thrown out of a car on this bridge over the Mississippi River. A New York Times reporter named Earl Caldwell saw a man in those bushes. A neighbor named Olivia Catling saw a man running out of an alleyway. So you have a lot of people had seen people in those bushes getting away. But the official story was that the shot did not come from the bushes. The shot came from inside the rooming house on South Main Street. From the shooter had to stand on top of the toilet in an upstairs bathroom to get a shot. That's the official story. And it's very interesting that the day after the assassination, those bushes in the backyard behind the rooming house were all cut down. Apparently the police had ordered a guy from the Public Works Department to cut down the bushes and kind of completely change the landscape. So think about that. Witnesses had seen smoke and people, shooters or men coming out of those bushes and getting away, but the official story is that the assassin was inside the building on a second floor bathroom firing out the window. Well, a man named James Earl Ray was named as a suspect. He was eventually caught. James Earl Ray was kind of a small-time criminal, and he had escaped from Missouri State Prison in 1967. According to William Pepper in his book, the warden of that prison was paid $25,000 by the FBI to arrange for James Earl Ray's escape. Apparently Ray escaped with it. He didn't know it was being arranged. He thought he was kind of an escape artist, and I think he got away in a bread truck or something. But anyway, and a witness had testified that the FBI's number two man, Clyde Tolson, who is J. Edgar Hoover's close friend, that brought $25,000 to bribe the warden of this Missouri prison to arrange for James Earl Ray's escape. So James Earl Ray, he's out of prison. He wants to get out of the country, and he does. He gets to Canada. There's a lot of details about him getting false papers and things like that, which kind of a little complicated to go into here. But he winds up in Montreal, hanging around in a tavern along the river, St. Lawrence Seaway. And he's hoping that he can somehow get on board a ship, arrange passes or something, and get out of the country. Well, in Montreal, he meets a man named Raoul. And Raoul hires Ray to help him with what he called a smuggling operation. And with the promise that Raoul would pay for James Earl Ray's living expenses and arrange to get him some kind of papers to help him get out of the country. So James Earl Ray goes to work for Raoul. First place they go is back into the United States. They go into Detroit. Other times they're down in Mexico just smuggling things across the border. And eventually, for a while, Ray is in L.A., kind of without too much to do, and he just kind of passes the time taking ballroom dance lessons and other kind of classes and just kind of hanging out in L.A. But then he gets, Raoul contacts him and has him come to Birmingham, I believe, to buy a rifle. So after the assassination, James Earl Ray did get to London. He was hoping, apparently, to get to Africa. He was caught at the Heathrow Airport, brought back to the United States. And there he got a court-appointed lawyer. One of his lawyers was Percy Foreman, who was a real big-time, well-connected Houston lawyer. Percy Foreman cajoles James Earl Ray into pleading guilty, sort of the idea being that he'll avoid the death penalty and whatever. And Ray does plead guilty, but then he tries to withdraw that plea, but he's unable to. So, in the meantime, he gets, he has pled guilty, he is sentenced to life in prison without parole. That presumably would be the end of it, but over the years, William Pepper and other people are beginning to have doubts about whether Ray was guilty or not. So William Pepper, who was a friend of Dr. King, as I mentioned before, a friend of the family, and a peace activist, he begins investigating this thing, and the more he investigates, the more it seems to him that James Earl Ray was not the guilty person. So he becomes Ray's lawyer, and he tries to get him not a new trial, but just a trial, which he never did have. He just had a plea session. But he's unable to get a new trial for him. So what he did something very interesting. He got the BBC to put on a kind of a mock trial on TV. And the idea was that they would make this trial as much like a real trial as possible. They would get a real judge to volunteer to act the role of judge. They would get a prosecuting attorney and whatever. And they would choose a jury, and then they would call witnesses. And by this time, Pepper had a bunch of witnesses to call. So they had this TV trial, and bearing in mind that it was a mock trial, it was not a real, but it was much like a real trial as they could make it. And the jury found Ray not guilty. Then, getting back to the scene in Memphis. Now, we set the scene that the Lorraine Motel was on Mulberry Street, and on across the street and up the yard were the backs of buildings on South Main. Well, there was a rooming house there there were several businesses, and there was a cafe, a Jim's Cafe, which was owned by a man named Lloyd Jowers. And after some years, Lloyd Jowers made a confession. And he was told, he told his story on ABC's TV Primetime Live. And his story was that he was paid a lot of money by a Memphis produce dealer named Frank Liberto, who had mafia connections. He was paid a lot of money to hire the killer and kind of oversee the assassination. The money apparently came from Carlo Marcello, who's a New Orleans mob boss. So Lloyd Jowers, his story was he was paid to hire the killer. He actually had a few meetings at the cafe with Memphis cops who were planning the assassination. And he was visited. One of the people planning the assassination was Raoul, the guy who had met James Earl Ray in Montreal. And Lloyd Jowers' story is this, that Raoul, shortly before the assassination, Raoul came to the cafe, delivered a rifle. Then on April 4th of 1968, the shooter and a spotter and Lloyd Jowers were in those bushes behind the cafe building, behind the rooming house. And from there, the shooter killed King with one shot. Then the rifle was passed to Lloyd Jowers, who brought it back into the cafe, broke it down and wrapped it up in a towel and stored it away under a counter. And the next day, somebody, I think Raoul, came and took the rifle away. Now, that was Lloyd Jowers' story. Later on, there were other witnesses. A woman named Betty Spates, who was a waitress at the cafe, said she saw Jowers with a rifle. She also saw a lot of money in an envelope at the cafe. And when she heard the shot, she saw Jowers running into the cafe with the rifle. Another person said that the day after, Jowers showed him the rifle. Another person said he was asked by Jowers, this person was kind of a hired thug working for some of the mafia people, and he was asked by Jowers to take care of people, quote, who knew too much. So Jowers offered to testify in a trial if he could get immunity. But the Memphis DA would not allow that. So Jowers did not tell a story to a criminal trial. Later on, by 1999, the King family were firmly convinced that James Earl Ray was innocent, and they brought a civil suit, and William Pepper was a lawyer for that. They brought a civil suit against Lloyd Jowers and others unknown, for the murder of Dr. Martin Luther King. So this is a real trial in Memphis. And since it was a civil trial, the degree of proof is slightly different from a criminal trial. In a criminal trial, a jury has to find a person guilty beyond all reasonable doubt. In a civil trial, they can find a person, the accused, responsible by a preponderance of evidence. So, keeping that in mind, the jury ruled that that Lloyd Jowers and other persons unknown were guilty of the murder of Martin Luther King, and they awarded the King family token damages of $100, because the King family was not doing this for the money. It's very interesting that after this trial, there was a story. I mean, it got in the newspapers, and you think there'd be some kind of response from authorities or the public or whatever, but there really wasn't. I tracked down. There was this, the Oregonian had the story on, I think, back on page 10, that a civil jury had found Jowers and others guilty of a conspiracy to murder Dr. King. But that seemed to be kind of the end of it. Eventually, James Earl Ray died in prison. A lot of people are dead and gone now, including Lloyd Jowers. But so basically, that is the scene. Is leaving out a lot of details because it is a complicated story. There are a lot of people involved in this, but the Army sniper team, who were on top of the railroad building, they were there as kind of backup. That in case nobody else shot Dr. King, the Army sniper, the Alpha 184 guy, was supposed to do it himself. But he never got the orders to fire, so he never did. And so the Army sniper team and the Army photographers just quietly left town. It's very interesting that these Army photographers actually got a picture of a person in those bushes behind the rooming house. And it was not James Earl Ray. So there we have it. William Pepper eventually is tracked down. The Raul really existed. His name was Raul Coelho, Coelho. And he emigrated to the U.S. from Portugal and possibly worked with military intelligence in Angola, which at one time was a Portuguese colony. Pepper had a photo of Raul, and this photo was picked out by five different witnesses in various connections as the man who did various things. So he wasn't just made up out of thin cloth. So that is the story right there. I really recommend this book. This is greatly enlarged on the Pepper's earlier books. And like I said, the half the book is appendices, which include court documents, witnesses' testimony, cross-examination, and other items of interest. This is not just some made-up story. And I would recommend to read it, track down all the connections, do more research, and find out as much as you can about this. I think we have a little bit of time. If anybody wants to give us a call, the number is 503-231-8187. You know, we talk a lot of these days about the deep state and what it is. Well, that was a deep state in action. Maybe the deepest deep state of all, because there's different definitions of a deep state. Some is just sort of the continuing bureaucracy, but the deep state really means kind of people doing some dreadful things behind the scenes. And I don't know, it just seems to me that, you know, presidents come and go, different parties win elections, but the war party always seems to win. Let's talk a little bit about the reason why Dr. King was assassinated. I said three reasons. One was his speech exactly 1 year before, the Riverside Church speech, coming out against the war in Vietnam, which got him a lot of heavy criticism. The other was his plan of the Poor People's Campaign, where they were going to fill the Washington Mall with a kind of a tent city of poor people, black and white, putting pressure on Congress to do something about poverty. And the third reason, I think, was that Dr. King was going to run for president with the baby doctor, Dr. Spock, against the war. And that is why he was assassinated. But we have somebody calling us in. Bruce is online. Morning, Bruce.
Morning, Pierre. Listen, about Raul, I know I was in Europe with my mom and my brother at that time.
Mm-hmm.
We went over. We were in Portugal. There was all kinds of news in all the cheaper, the kind of, the sensationalist magazines about, hey, James Earl Ray was here, and he was with a prostitute in Lisbon. That was part of his running away from the law. He was in London. He was in Lisbon. And I remember seeing the reviews that said, oh, yeah, here he was, and here's the girl that James Earl Ray was sleeping with, and, this is about Dr. King, etc. So that does lead credence to the fact that Raul was Portuguese, and maybe there was some connection as to, hey, you can go to Lisbon. We can get somebody to hide you there. And I remember that very distinctly. That was in 68. We went over there a couple of months in June, so a couple of months after the assassination.
Well, there's a lot more in the book about Raul. He was also involved with kind of gun running, which also involved Carlos Marcelo, where some crooked army people would steal rifles and sell them to Marcelo, who would transport them to Houston. And Raul, at that time, was sort of in charge of that operation. In fact, one of the witnesses who saw Raul's picture, picked him out, was a woman who was sort of on the fringes of that. So Raul was a pretty busy guy. And I don't know if he's still around or not, but he was supposedly an auto worker, but he had a lot of days off where he was not at the factory. And he had a wife and a family. But he was a very busy guy.
I also just assumed, once I looked into this years ago, I just assumed that James Earl Ray was an absolute crack shot marksman, as an Eagle Scout marksman. He had no real history with guns at all, except as a liquor store holdup man. And whoever took that shot, it was a single shot, and that was the end of it.
That's true. That's
amazing.
True.
Hey, great show. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for calling. I think people ought to get this book. The thing that amazes me, like we talked about the deep state. Well, the deep state is still with us. Ever since the assassination of Dr. King and the Kennedy brothers, this country has sort of been in constant war. And I just have to keep wondering, why are Americans not outraged? Here is all this evidence, and you can look at it and you can decide whether it's compelling or overwhelming or whatever, but here is real evidence of what went on with Dr. King. And I just have to ask, why aren't Americans outraged over this particular murder? Americans are certainly outraged over a lot of other things. I think our last election proved that. They're outraged over all kinds of stuff. But somehow I get the impression, this is my opinion, that people's outrage is being manipulated. Manipulated by Donald Trump, manipulated by the Democratic Party. It's being turned and targeted in all sorts of different ways. But here is something that is so important to our history, and is being ignored. To me, that is a very strange, very strange thing. So thank you for listening. I hope you will get this book, The Plot to Kill King, by William F. Pepper. It's really worth reading and pondering. Thank you again for listening. Stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
Yeah, good morning. It is KBOO Portland, your community radio station, a couple minutes before 10 o'clock. Join us at 10:15 for Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, your host. At 11 today, Between the Covers will feature author Otessa Moshfegh talking about her critically acclaimed short story collection, Homesick for Another World. And then at 11:30 today, it is Black Book Talk, featuring interviews and discussions of works by African-American authors. That is all coming up right after Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia with headlines, interviews, and commentary right after this.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Native Wisdom Films Festival on Saturday, April 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in Portland. The Native Wisdom Films Festival features four recent films directed by Lawrence Johnson: The People of the Caribou, The People of the Oregon Coast, The People of the Well, and The People of the Oregon Interior. Accompanying the films is a selection of shorts made by students in the Wisdom's Native Film Academy. Again, that's the Native Wisdom Films Festival, Saturday, April 15th, starting at 2 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Whistle Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.